For those of you who don't know me, my name is Dan Spencer, and the official title of this session is On Being a Geologian, Recovering a Creation-Centered Spirituality. A couple of notes before we begin. I couldn't have asked for better forerunners than Nancy, Kathleen, and Charles tonight. I'm going to be talking about creation-centered spirituality, and the Vespers tonight was pretty much right along those lines, as was the table prayer we did, table prayer number 9, which asks for the blessings on the land and the waters and abundant life from God, is very much out of this tradition. How I got to do this session. I missed planning meeting last week. Don't do that to last weekend. Folks scheduled me in for something, and I originally thought of doing what's been most interesting to me lately, which would be a book review on Matthew Fox's book, Original Blessing. Then some other folks mentioned they were hoping I would do something along the lines of geology, which I've done a few times before. So I got the brilliant idea of combining the two, and I'll do spirituality or geology, sort of. Actually, what I hope to do is spend about 15 or 20 minutes looking at some of the themes that come out of this book, Original Blessing, Creation-Centered Spirituality. My conversation partner in this a lot lately has been Jean Fernack. We've sort of gotten each other going on reading this, and it's really been delightful. It's, I think, as far as sort of theological, spiritual books, that the best one I've read this year, and I really recommend folks, if you get a chance, there's a copy in the library, although I think it's sold out in the bookstore now, but to read through some of it. Spend a little bit of time with that. Then I'm going to try and draw some connections from the spirituality towards how I do geology and how I enjoy geology. Shows a few slides that'll take us through the sequence of how a geologist approaches an area and reconstructs the story of the geology of that area. And then if we haven't run out of time, at the end I have about 15 minutes worth of slides and music just to enjoy. It'll be somewhat like Vespers was tonight, but we'll see how we're doing by that time. I didn't get going on this until about this afternoon, so it's not as polished as I would like it to be. But I'm going to work through just a few things in Matthew Fox and read some sections of his just to give you a flavor about what he means by creation-centered spirituality as opposed to what he calls fall redemption spirituality, which is, for most of us, probably the spirituality and the understanding of spirituality that we grew up with. Sets a sharp dualism between spirit and body, material and soul, that kind of thing. Matthew Fox poses two questions right at the beginning of his book to get us into why he thinks this is important. Number one, in our quest for wisdom and survival, does the human race require a new religious paradigm? And number two, does the creation-centered spiritual tradition offer such a paradigm? Read how he answers that. As the reader may guess, my answer to both of these questions is yes. When I use the word wisdom, I think of the definition that the Native American tradition gives us, that the people may live. I am very at home with this understanding of wisdom. I believe it encompasses the breadth and depth of cosmic and human living, and I believe it names what God the Creator wants for all of her children, that the people of this precious earth, all global peoples, may live. Bangladesh people, old people, hungry children people, robust adolescent people, people in socialist countries, people in capitalist countries, that the people may live. But wisdom wants the people to live. What does that mean? Obviously that they not die before their time. But what else does it mean? To live is not merely to survive. Living implies beauty, freedom of choice, giving birth, discipline, celebration. Living is not the same as going shopping or buying, nor is it the same as making a nest in which to escape the sufferings of one another. Living has something to do with Eros, the love of life, and with the love of others' lives, others' rights to Eros and dignity. Here lies wisdom, that the people may live. But where do we find it? That's how he sets up the opening part of his book, and he calls this book a journey. He says if it works at all, it will be a catalyst to get us all moving on our own paths and our own journeys. He looks then at what are some of the sources of wisdom, as he points out here. And two that he says have been traditional for people to look for have been nature, within nature, and within religious traditions. The unfortunate thing, he says, that we find in our case now in the Western world is that we have a split, a sharp dualism between what we think of as science and what we think of as religion. And this is, you can trace to about the 17th century. Up until that point, there was a pretty good overlap between people who studied nature and people who thought about theology and religious questions. But with the Enlightenment and in the last three or four centuries, there's been a sharp split. And Fox, among others, claimed that this split has been disastrous for the world as we know it. For what it's done is it's taken religious questions and put them in the realm of privatized, personal questions, and taken science and made it become what he calls a violent employee of technology. It's split science and how we understand science from any questions of deeper values, and it's taken religion out of the world of creation and privatized it to how I look at myself and fit in with a few other things. He says that part of the consequence of this has been religion has developed the fall redemption spirituality, which he traces to Augustine. And what this spirituality basically does is begins with the sinful condition of humanity and looks at humanity and says, how can I as a human being who has fallen be saved? And so the spirituality stays within the realm of humanity and never moves out beyond that to the world of creation. He says this has had disastrous consequences. And if we're going to be able to answer the question of survival and the question of searching for wisdom, we need to be able to dare to look beyond those roots and expand our spirituality. I'll read a quote here that he talks about. But how about religion? Is it in touch with its sources of wisdom? Is it willing to let go of outdated, dualistic paradigms with the courage with which science lets go? Alfred North Whitehead writes, religion is tending to degenerate into a decent formula wherewith to embellish a comfortable life. Religion will not regain its old power until it can face change in the same spirit as does science. To recover the wisdom that is lurking in religious traditions, we have to let go of more recent religious traditions. Only those who dare to let go can dare to re-enter, advises Meister Eckhart. Specifically, what religion must let go of in the West is an exclusively fall redemption model of spirituality, the model that has dominated theology, Bible studies, seminary, and novitiate training for centuries. It is a dualistic model and a patriarchal one. It begins its theology with sin and original sin, and it generally ends with redemption. Fall redemption spirituality does not teach believers about the new creation or creativity, does not teach believers about justice making and social transformation, or about eros, play, pleasure, and the God of delight. It fails to teach love of the earth or care for the cosmos, and it is so frightened of passion that it fails to listen to the impassioned pleas of the Anawi, the little ones of human history. This same fear of passion prevents it from helping lovers to celebrate their experiences as spiritual and mystical. This tradition has not proven friendly to artists or prophets or Native American peoples or women. Let's stop for a little autobiographical note here, explaining some of why I found this so exciting. Most of you know I studied geology in college, and geology for me was a way of gaining deeper and deeper reverence for the earth, and it really was a wonderful field to be in. But I had a hard time connecting it up with my faith. I didn't have any spiritual resources that allowed me to see my study of the world and study of creation connected up with my understanding of being born again or being saved or any of those spiritual resources. And especially when I decided to go to seminary, people would often ask me, well, theology and geology, how are you going to combine those two? And I was never able to articulate it. I knew that some of the deepest feelings that were triggered by studying geology for me were also the same ones that my faith triggered. But I didn't have any way to really combine the two. And so for me to read a paragraph like this out of Fox, talking about love for the new creation and reverence for that, was very exciting. The other thing that ended up sending me to seminary, as some of as you know, was my experience at Holden of learning about social justice concerns and how that related to the faith. In particular, there's a film about Domingo da Câmara, the Archbishop of Brazil, that we saw a few weeks ago, where he talks specifically about these connections. And then to read in the same paragraph here at Fox about creation-centered spirituality teaching us about social transformation and liberation, and about listening to the marginalized people, the little ones, the Anawim of history. I found my two main delights and the two areas of my deepest sense of values, creation and justice, being incorporated in one spirituality. And so it excited me to continue reading on to see how I could overcome some of the splits that I'd experienced between science and religion. We've talked a little bit about this in Winter Program this last time, about how we would define spirituality. It's one of those words that everybody uses, but it's hard to get a grasp on what we mean by it. And I guess I would define spirituality as the art of living. It's the way we take our deepest values and embody them and live them out. And it overcomes then some of the dualisms between thinking and feeling and acting. It's the way we do all of those and take our deepest values and live them out. So for tonight, we'll call spirituality as the art of living. One of the things that Matthew Fox points out is that the creation-centered spirituality is far, far older than the fall redemption spirituality that we've come to learn for the most part. Indeed, the oldest writers of the Bible, the Yahwist tradition in the Old Testament and some of those areas, are full of a creation-centered spirituality. You read the Psalms, the Song of Solomon, the stories in the Old Testament, and they're very full of the blessings of God and the gift of the earth. And out of that blessing, then, life moves forward. And it's only with the entrance of some of the Greek philosophical traditions, specifically Neoplatonism in the 3rd and 4th centuries of after Christ, that Christian writers begin to pick up some of the sharp dualisms and split between spirit and body. And Augustine then developed the notion of original sin. It's very interesting. If you read the scriptures, there's no notion of original sin. In fact, Augustine based his theology on a mistranslation. But it caught on in Christianity and has been developed since then, so that the original sin has too often become our starting point for spirituality. We see ourselves as fallen creatures, as that's the beginning point, and then we occupy our spirituality with how then do we become redeemed in the sight of the righteous, judging God. Fox lists 10 reasons for moving to a creation-centered spirituality, for recreating a culture and what he calls creating the first global culture. I listed them here. You're probably not going to be able to see them, but let me go over them really quickly. The first, he says, are the two crises that face the world today that have, in many ways, can be traced to the failure to have a creation-centered spirituality. The first one is the ecological crisis, and I don't think we need to elaborate on that. It's been very well documented. He calls the culminating point of the ecological crisis the nuclear crisis. That in itself culminates our ability and threat to destroy creation and the environment around us. And second, and going along with that, is the economic crisis, specifically mass unemployment worldwide, where you have economies that are split up so that some countries serve as colonies, basically, for other wealthier countries, and huge amounts of unemployment and mass underemployment going on in those two. Both of these, he says, are not addressed by a fall redemption spirituality, but are when we stop and begin to think of our interconnectedness in a creation spirituality. Second, he talks a little bit about the scientific awakening that's going on in the science community and is somewhat leaving theology behind, or that leaving the world of theology is being left behind if it doesn't address this. For the past 200 years, science has operated pretty much out of what's known as a Newtonian paradigm, the physics of Newton, which were very much a mechanistic. You could create formulas that would tell you exactly how nature would react to everything. So begin to see as nature as mechanical. That is proving to not be the case, the best way of explaining and understanding nature. And science more and more is working out of a paradigm which sees nature as an organism, that we're all interconnected, that we are a living organism, and that's the paradigm science is now beginning to work out of. What Fox will argue is that we need to catch up and reincorporate that in our spirituality. Thirdly, the global ecumenism that's going on, people of different faiths talking to each other, trying to look at points they have in common rather than starting off with their points of differences and developing alienation that way. Fourth is the growing reality of justice and liberation movements in the world today, particularly in what we call the third world, the nations of Asia, Africa, and Latin America. But the movements of the poor and the oppressed for their liberation is shaking the world as we know it. fifth, feminism and the overcoming of patriarchal traditions and strong dualisms that have shaped our understanding of the world. Sixth, a need to recapture hope in the face of mass cynicism and despair. And he lists seven and eight as two different kinds of transformation. One, religious transformation that's undergoing as a result of these, and educational transformation as scholars are beginning to realize, understand the different process of the ways we learn. What we talk about holding here is right brain versus left brain. Our education has become very over-intellectualized and analytical and logical and rational to the detriment of our right brain, which is much stronger in the arts, in the feeling, intuition, those ways of learning. And so education is being transformed as we reincorporate that. And what Fox argues is that a creation-centered spirituality allows us to do these kinds of things because it works out of creation, it works out of the context of blessing, and encourages our imagination and our visioning and dreaming. The old model that of the fall redemption spirituality operates out of a threefold path that many of you may be familiar with. It starts with purgation or cleansing or denial, that aspect, then illumination, and then finally union with some higher realm. So the threefold path would be purgation or denial, illumination, and union. And I don't know how many folks here have studied much in terms of theology, but this is pretty much what I learned in seminary. The great mystics would go through great periods of asceticism, of denial, of fasting, and so forth, then reach illumination and finally have some sense of union with a spirituality that was divorced from the physical world. Fox claims that the creation-centered spirituality, which is a much older form, follows instead a fourfold path of what he calls the four vias, via being Latin for the way or the path. The via positiva, the via negativa, via creativa, or creativa, and the via transformativa. And let me just read one of his quotes here to show a little bit what each one of those are. It's sort of the order they happen is the way Fox experiences his spirituality. First he says, these paths are spiral, not ladder-like. Like the movements of a symphony, each of the paths spirals in and out of the others until the spiritual journey expands and expands. And within the paths, each of the themes also spirals in and out of the others. This interweaving, interconnecting, interdependent spiraling can easily carry us beyond Augustine and beyond Newton. The reader of the book will realize how thoroughly interconnected all the themes and paths are. Path one, the via positiva, which is befriending creation, cannot be fully experienced without path two, the via negativa, of befriending darkness and letting go, letting be. This path, in turn, finds its fulfillment in path three, the via of creation, of befriending creativity, since all creativity, as distinct from reshuffling, is from nothingness and darkness. And finally, path four, the via transformativa and the befriending of the new creation, fulfills path three, for the direction of increased compassion as celebration and justice, for the direction of increased compassion as celebration and justice is the direction our creativity needs to take us. Yet path four reconnects with path one, just as new creation is related to creation itself. Around each of these paths, we can ask what art, politics, and science have to teach us, as well as theology. An important point there, he's saying that our spirituality is informed by the whole world, not just by our theological concepts, but by art, by politics, by whatever moves in the world. And that we start by looking at creation and the blessings that we're given in creation. Then we move into experiencing the darker side of creation, which is suffering and pain and loss. But we don't experience it by denying it. We move into it, experience it, let it go, and let it be. Out of that, then, we can experience creativity and embrace that. And finally move into new creation, where we become one with the process of creation, using our creativity to move towards greater wholeness. And this, he says, then, is the fourfold path of spirituality. I don't want to get too carried away here because I want to have some time for some geology. But one of the, I guess the major point is that the starting point then becomes what he calls original blessing. It begins with understanding ourselves as being part of creation, that we've been blessed with many gifts, rather than starting as with original sin as being fallen creatures. We understand our brokenness and our alienation within the context of blessing, of having so many of these gifts. One of the themes, the chapters he talks about here, which I most enjoy, is what he calls is on humility, how we understand our humility as part of our spirituality. Traditionally, humility is understood more in terms of self-denial, of self-abnegation. We have this concept: in order to give God the glory, we have to think of ourselves as less worthy and less full beings. And so we go through pains of a process of denial, to deny ourselves any worth. The creation-centered spirituality has a different concept of humility. First, it notes that the word humility comes from the word humus, which means the earth. And our humility is basically our earthiness. It's our connectedness with all of creation that allows us to see precisely where we fit into the whole scheme of things, that we are one part of a very much broader world, a broader creation. And so it allows us to overcome our false senses of importance that divorces ourselves from the natural world and allows us to see our interconnectedness with all things, which leads to our humility. He talks about a modern-day synonym of humility being simplicity, that understanding of ourselves and how we fit into things that allows us to let go of accumulating things, of possessing things, and live the art of simplicity, where we become one with the world around us. That's some of the areas I'm going to stress tonight in how I do geology. How geology for me becomes an art or a step in the art of humility and understanding myself within the scheme of a much larger world. I guess let me just say how I do this a little bit. For me, geology is telling stories at its best. It's telling creation stories. One of the things I most enjoyed about geology is being with other geologists, because overall they're just a delightful breed of people, I have found. It's a little pat on the back, but basically, if you're going to be a good geologist, you've got to have a certain number of skills. You have to be a good observer of things. You have to have a wild imagination, because the stories and things you think up to explain the things around us aren't written anywhere. You've got to be able to imagine them out of your history. You've got to be able to think back millions and even billions of years about how things might have been and work out a process that explains what we see today. Field geology is just a delightful thing, because you spend your day tromping around the woods and the rocks and everything, banging away at things, looking at things closely, and then you spend your evening sitting around the campfire seeing who can spin the best yarn out of other things. But I think the two are interrelated, our ability to tell stories and our ability to do geology and think through creation stories. So that's what I want to do tonight. I pulled out three slides, but I want to go through the process of telling a creation story with you. And then I have a fourth slide that we'll do together before we go into the rest of the slides. Before I do that, though, are there any questions as far as what I've just really gone through quickly from original blessing? I realize I've gone through it very fast and lightly. I'm just hoping to get you enticed enough that you'll read it on your own. Yeah?
I have one question, and it's kind of a matter of conscience that I bring this up. I have to contest one point you made on the idea of fall and redemption type of thing originating with Augustine. I see that in the earliest of the Jewish traditions, namely the Eden story. Mm-hmm. I see it in the Jesuit tradition with Jesus. Once I saw a cartoon and Jesus was on the cross and he says, looking down at these people, he says, if I'm okay and you're okay, then what am I doing up here? And it's in the Pauline tradition with Adam, and we are born like Adam, we are sinful like Adam. It's in the Johannine tradition, we who say we have no sin deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. I don't disagree with everything you're saying at all, but I do disagree with that.
Okay, thanks for bringing that up. I obviously don't have time to deal with all of it tonight. All I'll say is, I'll again make the claim that I think you're reading Scripture and reading Jesus and reading Paul through Augustinian eyes, which all of us have been trained to do. Creation-centered spirituality does not deny the reality of sin. It sees it more as brokenness within a world of blessing rather than as an original state that we're born into. What it sees Jesus then, and I think this is more in line with the Old Testament expectations, was a liberator to bring wholeness back to the community of Israel and to bring liberation, rather than saving individual souls who had fallen and now needed to be redeemed. In Winter Program, we looked at Paul through the eyes of, or Krister Stendahl's study of Paul among Jew and Gentile, which got away from looking at the dualistic understanding of Paul to looking more as a Hebrew in his time would have understood him. And these categories, these rigid dualistic categories, were foreign to the Hebrew concept in that time. But thank you for, if I was giving the impression that there was no concept of sin there, I don't want to give that.
Okay.
The concept of sin that it develops is more of separation and dualism.
There's also creation, definitely a creation-type theology.
Yeah.
With the fall in Eden, you have, and God saw that it was good.
Mm-hmm. Within that, what you see there is a context of original blessing of the whole Eden story and creation, and then within that brokenness that happens through separation, through dualism, through exploitation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the two very much go hand in hand.
Okay.
That's, what's the original blessing?
What is the original blessing?
Yeah, I mean.
Oh, that's. I wanted to read one quote, so I'm glad you brought that up. Let me just say that I sort of skipped over here because I was obviously spending too much time on this, but it's just a delightful quote for me because it's exactly how I understand. I had it written down here. Part of the real wonder of geology is, for me, is trying to grasp the sense of geologic time. Our sense of time is it's hard. When you talk about a million years and a billion years, how do you even begin to grasp what's the difference between a million years and a billion years? And yet a geologist will say that something that's a million years old is very, very young, whereas a billion years old is relatively old. Trying to grasp the sense of time and then seeing myself as someone who's going to live 50 to 70 years within that has been part of gaining that sense of humility, that sense of interconnectedness with a long creation story and learning my place within that. Fox has a delightful quote in response in this about, it's again with the concept of original sin in mind. He says, talking about original sin, there's a genuine scandal involved in this dangerous distortion of life in the biblical data. The scandal is one of ignoring and then despising creation and those who love creation, such as Native American peoples or matriarchal religions. Even if original sin is to be taken literally, still the facts are as follows, that if we take the universe to be about 20 billion years old, as scientists are advising us to do, then sin of the human variety is about 4 million years old, since that is how long humans have been around. But creation is 19,996,000,000 years older. Fall redemption theology has ignored the blessing that creation is because of its anthropomorphic preoccupation with sin. The result has been, among other things, the loss of pleasure from spirituality, and with this loss, the increase of pain, of injustice, of sadomasochism, and of distrust. 19 billion years before there was any sin on earth, there was blessing. What is original blessing? He talks of just the gift that creation is and the marvelous fact that creation keeps unfolding and that whole sense of being gifted by everything around us as being our original blessing. And from his perspective, we've entered in very late on this thing. I wanted to tie in here for some of you who were here during Advent. I recognize that isn't very many now. I did a Matins service on geological time as Advent is the season of hope. And we had been talking in text study, well, if Jesus was the liberator and was supposed to bring shalom, the sense of wholeness to the earth, but 2,000 years have passed and obviously hadn't happened. How are we supposed to keep waiting with expectation when so long of a time had passed? So I brought in the sense of geologic time just to give us a more of a creation-centered sense of time rather than a human-centered sense of time. And one of the things you do then is, well, one of the ways of looking at it, if the earth is about 4.5 billion years old, you can set that up as a calendar and just mark off the events that happen on the calendar of the year. One of the things you notice then is that it's not until September that the first beginnings of life begin to develop. So you go all the way from January, March, all that stuff, all the way to September, and life begins to develop. It's not until November that life becomes sophisticated enough that it begins to leave behind fossils. That is, you get small enough pieces of life that leave behind fossils in the rock record. It's not until December that you start getting trees developing. It's not until mid-December that the dinosaurs appear. It's not until December 26th that the first human beings even start to begin to evolve. It's not until 5 seconds before midnight that Jesus Christ appears, and counting us as midnight on New Year's Eve. So if you begin to look at that sense of time, we're rushing to a climax, a culmination of Jesus as the liberator coming in, rather than having Jesus come and then have this long period of nothing happening. It's just a different exercise in trying to see, again, our interconnectedness and where we fit in on things. When you realize that human beings don't even enter into the picture until a few minutes before midnight on New Year's Eve, that for me then becomes a true sense of humility, our true sense of interconnectedness with things, rather than a grand preoccupation with how human beings are going to save the universe. I have a tendency to start preaching, so be careful when you ask questions. Let's go with some of the slides. I have to warn you, I just pulled these slides out a couple hours ago. I don't even know what I'm going to say, but I'm going to try and work out some of the geologies as a geologist would approach this. Someone just turn on the slide projector there, and I'll turn on the slides. It's when we're going to reconstruct a fairy tale creation story here.
You're just good.
I reconstruct part of Leo when I get through. All right. As you look at this scene, just start to observe different things in it. And I want to just point out how a geologist, when she or he would come upon something like this, I hope the person would stop and marvel first before they would get too caught up in what happens. Let me just go through and reconstruct some of the things that geologists start to notice. Start noticing shapes, colors, obviously the size of the mountains, the range in there, what kind of rocks are present, what kind of topography we have left today. One of the first things a geologist would notice is all the rocks are layered. Okay, you can see these long layers that come across through the mountains here. This is Glacier National Park in Montana, for folks who don't know. This clues us into the kind of rocks we are, and we want to look closer at what they are to see what kinds of things they tell us about. Another thing a geologist would notice, you aren't going to be able to see it very well here, but there's a broad plateau here of a different kind of rock. As you look closer at it, it turns out to be lava flows and igneous rocks. So we want to figure out how to put those two together. Sedimentary rocks tend to form in very low, stable areas where there are very little disturbances. And yet now we've got these upthrust in the mountains. So something's happened between the formation of these rocks and where they are today. The mountains themselves have different kinds of shapes. They have broad, U-shaped valleys. And if you've listened to me for the last several months, you know that broad, U-shaped valleys scream glacier. So this area has been glaciated. We want to understand, try and figure out what has happened in that process. Today, you see other features. You've got waterfalls here. There's a long lake down the valley here, a couple lakes here. So these are the kind of things that we start looking at. Here's a glacier back here that's left on the side of one of the mountains. So these are kind of puzzle pieces we'll begin to look at to figure this situation out. As we look closer, you can't get all this from the picture, but this is what the kind of questions a geologist would ask. We look at these rock features here. One of the first things we'll notice, we've got several thousand feet of rocks and almost no fossils in them. No fossils as we know them in terms of fossil plants, fossil fish, fossil animals, or that kind of thing. And as it turns out, these rocks are old enough that they formed before plant life and animal life developed enough to leave behind fossils. We do find some what are called petrified algae. They're basically big algae colonies that grew in some area and solidified as the rocks formed. So that we know that it was an underwater environment that fostered algae. We find ripple marks, which are marks that are left behind by waves when they pass through. If you go down to Lucerne or go along any beach where there's wave motion, look along the bottom of the lake bed there, you'll see ripple marks, these little undulations in the sand where the wave movement comes along. You know that for ripple marks to form, the sea has to be fairly shallow, because if it's deep, the waves won't be able to affect the floor. So we know we've got a shallow sea. We know we've got some kind of broad, extensive life of colonies of algae forming. We have several thousand feet of rocks that have basically the same patterns in them. So we know we're talking in terms of millions and millions of years of environment that did not change very much. In fact, as we begin to date these rocks through various means, it turns out we have a sequence of about 600 million years where the sea basically did not change at all. In the midst of this, we have a lava flow, and so in other areas where the lava squeezed into rocks. Igneous rocks, or rocks that cool from a liquid, leave behind minerals that we can date. When the minerals cool from a liquid form, there's radioactive minerals within them that begin to degenerate from that point on, and you can date those. When we date the rocks in this lava flow, they come out to a little over 1 billion years old. So now we have a way that we can date about how old these seas were. And it turns out that they existed from about 800 million years ago, way back to 1400 million, or 1.4 billion years ago. So we were talking about an area that existed over a broad area, a large sea, fairly stable, that for millions and hundreds of millions of years had sediment brought into it and had large algae things. A comparable kind of environment today would be the area around the Bahama Banks down in the Caribbean, or the Great Barrier Reef out in Australia. Areas that are pretty stable where you have large flat areas that don't change too much. Okay, the next step then is we don't have anything younger than 800 million years, and so whatever was once on top has been stripped away. As we start to study more, we will look at the structure of the area. We want to look at the faults and the folds to figure out how these rocks got into their place. Overall, they're basically flat-lying, although there are some undulations, some folds. But as we begin to study more about the geology around this area, we can reconstruct some of the events that happened. For those of you, this isn't going to work very well, I realize, because there's not much light, but I did bring my different shirts. This is my doing geology in a revolutionary situation. One of the things that's happened in geology in the last 15 to 20 years has been the emergence of plate tectonic theory. And plate tectonics says that the Earth is the surface of the Earth is divided up into a relatively small number of large plates, or large sections of the Earth that move relative to each other. For example, North America would be moving relative to the floor of the ocean, of the Pacific Ocean. What happened within the last 100 million years or so is that the Pacific plate began to collide with the North American plate. And as you collide two things, the edges will start to crumple upward, and that gives us the mountains. This is a very simplistic picture, but that's basically the kind of thing that's happened to form the mountains along the western part of the United States, reaching from the coastal ranges like the Cascades and the Sierras down in California into the Rocky Mountains there. The oceanic plate begins to slip underneath the continental plate, North America. The edge of the plate gets crumpled up into mountains, and you have also volcanism to explain on the next slide. Anyway, so we've got the two different periods now, 600 million years of forming rocks under a sea, and now we've got the uplifting beginning to happen. That in itself will explain the mountains, but it doesn't explain the present shape of them. What happened within the last 4 or 5 million years is we've had several different ice ages. No one's exactly sure why the ice ages happened. There are a number of different theories about why it may be decreased sunlight for different reasons, whatever. But in various times, the ice caps on the poles, or over the Arctic Ocean and Antarctica now, have spread outwards and downward, covering large parts of the continents, North America, Northern Europe, Asia, with great ice caps. And this has happened in this area too. What happens then is the ice will build up over these mountain areas and will take formerly V-shaped narrow valleys and scour them out, leaving broad U-shaped areas. That's what's happened in the glacier area here. So we're going to reconstruct a creation story out of this area. We begin something along this line. Once upon a time, many, many years ago, the land looked very different than it does today. There was a large ocean spread out all over the land, and things were stable and peaceful and happy. For hundreds and hundreds of millions of years, nothing disturbed this peaceful sea. In came the sediment, things piled up, the algae mats were very happy, nothing changed. Then suddenly the continents began to move and there was rumbling at the edges and the Pacific plate began to bump against the North American plate. And up came the uprising and the uplift, and you can have revolutionary masses if you want, but there's a... that was being formal on the edges there. And so we have a revolutionary situation where mountains are beginning to form. Within this continent, you have some of the volcanism, the lava flows, and so forth, and the mountains begin to move upward, and are still moving upward today. You can have an Arctic god or whatever becoming angry, and the ice begins to move down off the globes and covers the area with an ice mantle. The ice then carves away and thinks, and as the area warms up, the ice begins to recede, and we're left with the scene we have today. The exciting thing to realize, of course, is this is not an end product so much as just one step along the way, and we don't know what will happen next. But we're catching one moment in the creation story, and we happen to be here at that time. Any questions on this particular scene before we go on to the next one? All right, the next slide. Okay, anyone recognize this peak? Okay, Mount Shasta, down Northern California. What kind of geologic feature is this?
Volcano.
And if you've been around me for a while, you know this. Okay, we're presented here with a very different kind of geologic story, a creation story that's different than what we've had before, but some similarities. Let me go ahead and point out some of the features we're going to want to look at and try and explain. One of the things that's more fun about this area is it's much more recent than the last one. These are all much younger features geologically. In fact, this lava flow right here is probably less than 1,000 years old, which geologically speaking is today. So this area is forming right before our very eyes. Hard to see, but there are some mountains behind Mount Shasta over here that have a different kind of rock than Mount Shasta is made up of. Everything you see in the foreground is made up of igneous rock, of lava flows, and these were rocks that began as liquid, molten rock, very hot, below the surface, and then erupted upwards, flowed out over the surface, cooled, and kept accumulating that way. The mountains behind there, which are known as the Marble Mountains, or the Trinity Alps, the Klamath Range, very different kind of mountains. They are metamorphic rocks that have formed along the edge of the continent and then have been plastered onto the continent. We have a situation out here very much like we see along the Pacific coast of Asia today. What do you people know about the Pacific coast of Asia if you look over what's off of China in that area? Islands. You've got Japan, you've got the Philippines, you've got all the islands that stretch up and down there. If you were to somehow mush those islands onto the coastland, then you would get the kind of rocks that we have over here. And in fact, that's what happened. We'll get to that part. That'll be the earliest part of our story, and we'll talk about that in just a minute. But the other things we want to see, we've got the presence of a very large volcano here, covered with snow and ice. Then we've got some very interesting looking things here. A lava flow that's so young that it has very few trees growing on it. If you were able to get close to this lava flow, you'd see that it's made up of obsidian, which is natural glass. It's the kind of rock that cooled so quickly that the minerals didn't have time to crystallize, and they cooled into a glass. Then you've got some smaller peaks over here that are covered with pumice. Pumice is merely volcanic glasses full of bubbles. It's the froth that forms on top of a lava flow. As the obsidian flow moves out, the gases escape and you form a froth on top, just like in a bubble bath. So that gets picked up in the air, blown away, cools, and it coats the surrounding covers, leaving these white covered peaks. We're going to reconstruct the geology of this area and get a little creation story here. Again, we have a situation similar to what we had last time in terms of what's happening with the continents. About 100 million years ago or so, this area, the Pacific plate, the ocean
floor, the rocks there began to move against the North American floor. And what you have is a situation known as subduction. The ocean floor is made of heavier rock than the continental floor, and so it begins to move down underneath it. What happens then is you have rocks that form on the ocean floor at conditions of pressure and temperature that are stable at surface conditions. But as you move them down underneath the other continent, they get more and more pressure on them, and they get hotter and hotter because you increase the heat of the Earth as you move towards the center. These rocks then become unstable and begin to melt. A liquid is more buoyant than a solid, and so as the rocks begin to melt, they'll begin to migrate upwards, and that's what leads to the volcanoes. That's why, if you notice, all along the Pacific coast, the north coast, from Washington, Oregon, and Northern California, you have a string of volcanoes inland, Mount Shasta, Mount Hood, Mount Rainier, Glacier Peak, all the way up, where you have the same situation going on today, of one plate colliding with another, moving along, melting, and forming volcanoes. We get a bunch of different kinds of volcanoes depending on the area we're in. One particularly, Mount Shasta is what's known as an andesite cone. It's an andesite is a particular kind of volcano or rock, and it leads to multiple eruptions that lead to fairly steep-sided volcanoes. But there are other kinds of magmas or lavas that form that lead to different kinds of things. One of the things we find along here is some of the magmas are a lot like oil and vinegar. They do real well as long as you keep them agitated, but if you start to let them settle, they'll split out. And you'll get a very silica-rich magma and a very silica-poor. Silica is the mineral that makes up quartz, a very light-colored one. If you tap then this magma chamber, you've got an area underneath the surface of the Earth where you have this liquid rock sitting. If you tap it and it begins to erupt, you'll get two different kinds of lava flows coming out. One of these will be what is called rhyolite, or what forms obsidian. It's very silica-rich, tends to cool very quickly, and it forms natural glass. And that's what's happened here to form this lava flow, which is Little Glass Mountain. And then you have the froth boiling out of that. The interesting thing to think about is this flow is so young that very likely, in fact, we're pretty sure that there is an active magma chamber right underneath at this point today. So there is a very likelihood we'll have eruptions in the future from this area. Where the magma is sitting down, the liquid rock is sitting there waiting until it has a weakness and can erupt up again.
That's,
yeah.
When you say right underneath, how far underneath is that?
Probably, I would guess 2 to 3 miles, probably. Relatively close to the surface. This is an area where they're drilling now for geothermal energy because the rocks are so hot and there are a number of hot springs in the area that they can tap the water that comes from the melting snow, seeps down, comes in contact with the hot rocks, rises as steam. Same kind of thing happens in Yellowstone. But this is an area that I spent a summer in working for the U.S. Geological Survey, mapping the area, and we were able to document that the volcano that's to my back, that you can't see in the picture here, has had two eruptions that are probably the same size and magnitude as the one Mount St. Helens had 4 years ago. And those have been within the last 100,000 years or so. So it's a very active area geologically. Final stage in our story too is the ice age didn't get the ice itself didn't get down this far, but the climate cooled enough that you had glaciers form on Mount Shasta, and there are remnant glaciers today that are 6 glaciers that stay up on the mountain itself, collect the snows and keeping glaciers. Any questions on this one before we go on to the next?
That area in the foreground, that obsidian, is that from Mount Shasta?
No,
that's from the one to your back.
It's probably from, I'm standing on the edge of the one to my back, which is, it's called the Medicine Lake Highlands, or Medicine Lake called there. If any of you get down to Lava Beds National Monument, Northern California, it's that area we're talking about. And then, yeah, we're about 35 miles from Mount Shasta, so we're probably in a different magma chamber than Mount Shasta. The thing is, so, when you're mapping volcanic rocks, it's very different than mapping other kinds of rocks, because sedimentary rocks form on a nice, cohesive layer cake pattern. One forms on top of another, forms on top of another. The ones on the bottom are the oldest, the ones on top are the youngest. But volcanic rocks form totally differently because you've got lava flows that just come up in like mud pies and plop themselves all over the place. And so you can't necessarily tell how old this rock is relative to this rock. So what you try and do is study all the different lava flows, try and get an age sequence out of them, and try and piece together the eruption history of the volcano. part of doing that then is if you can, every volcano has a very, its own unique eruption pattern. If you can get some sense of the pattern, then you can start to predict both what kinds of eruptions it has and how frequent they have. One of the things that we were able to determine now is that we are in probably the third phase. This volcano has had two very violent eruptive stages before. And the way that they are clued off, that it will have several small eruptions of obsidian flows and basalt flows before it will have a gigantic eruption like Mount St. Helens did. You can trace two of these previously. We seem to be in the third stage right now before a big eruption stage because there are a number of these obsidian flows and a number of basalt flows, which is a much darker fluid type, on the volcano that all date within the last 1,000 years or so. And so it's very likely within the next few 1,000 years, we can't say whether it's tomorrow or 5,000 years from now, this volcano may have another very large eruption. And it's significant for the people living nearby. It's a big farming area and interesting area.
What is the thing that looks like a valley through the middle of the
right through here?
Yeah.
Okay, what you've actually had here is you've had some different pulses in the lava flow. This is an earlier flow here. And then later on, another vent opened up here and has flowed against it. And so you're seeing the wall of the second flow that's come up against this earlier flow. Okay, to give you some idea, that the obsidian is a kind of lava that's very viscous. Viscous just means very thick and very hard to move. It's so viscous that you could take a sledgehammer and hit it and it wouldn't dent. And yet still, it's liquid enough that it will flow. It moves on the order of a few inches to a few feet a day. Now, basalt, on the other hand, is a kind of lava that is much less viscous. It's very runny. It can move up to 100 miles an hour. So you're talking about two kinds of volcanic rocks. They're both from liquid magmas, but very different properties. And so this kind of eruption, you could sit and watch a few feet away and not feel any danger. Whereas a lava flow like on Mount in Hawaii, where they're having their homes threatened, is one that's coming from a basalt, which is much more viscous and will flow.
Question about lava flow. You mentioned Hawaii. I was just about to ask, their lava is black.
Yeah, and it's basalt.
And is this part basalt or not?
There is a lot of basalt in the area. All these hills here are made up of basalt. It'll vary in color from black to red. It gets this reddish color because it has a lot of iron in it that will oxidize and rust when it gets in contact with the air. The Hawaiian volcanoes will do that too, but they're so recent and young they haven't had a chance to. The difference between basalt is basalt cools quickly enough that it has different properties. It very rarely forms a glass. And so it forms a very fine-grained rock that looks very dark and black. Whereas the obsidian, the reason it looks light-colored here is because it has pumice on top. It has that froth on top. The rock itself is a black, black glass. In fact, I'm sure Dorothy probably has some in the lapidary. She can show people.
Yeah,
A couple hundred pounds, yeah. That's in my room, too. The pumice is fine because it floats. It's, you know, if you want to have a rock that floats, just pick up a piece of pumice. Why don't we go to the next slide unless there's some... Okay, this is what I wanted to do for our area. We'll do it really quickly. In some other sessions I've done, I've talked at length about the history of the Holden area. I just want to go through a couple things again. What a geologist would look for when they saw this area. Again, in terms of landforms, one of the very obvious things right away, nice U-shaped valley. So you know this area has been glaciated. But you'd look at the rock types, and although you can't see it here because of the snow and stuff, and you'd have to look more closely, there are a lot of different rock types in Holden. We've gone through two different rock types so far. The first slide we looked at was sedimentary rocks, which are rocks that form in the sea, under the sea, where sand is being brought in, mud is being brought in, and they just pile up layer cake style. The last picture we looked at was igneous rocks, where you have volcanoes that form and bring in liquid rock up or molten rock from below and erupt out and form that way. Holden has a large area of what's known as metamorphic rock. Metamorphic rocks form from either sedimentary rocks or from igneous rocks. They're basically just rocks that have changed their form, meta and form, meaning changed formed rocks. All of Martin Ridge is made up of what are called schists and gneisses. If any of you have climbed Martin Ridge or get a chance to be on Martin Ridge sometime, you'll notice there are long layers of rocks that are formed this way. And that's very typical of gneisses and schists. One will be very white and quartz rich, the next will be very dark, and they'll just alternate in layers. They'll break along those spaces. This is because metamorphic rocks, the ones in Martin Ridge, have formed from earlier sediments. You had a situation where you had sedimentary rocks piling up, and as they do, they get deeper and deeper. The pressure increases on them, they begin to heat up as well, and the minerals in them are no longer stable, so will begin to change in their shape and their form. It's just as you can imagine, if you take sugar or put it in something or chop it and heat it, it'll change its form, and if you cool it, it'll recrystallize out in different things. That's what's happened all along Martin Ridge. We can, in fact, there are two different periods, and if you study the area, you can trace a history out that looks somewhat as follows. Probably 300 or 400 million years ago, we were in an area much like the last picture I showed, that had a lot of volcanoes, a lot of lava flows piling up on top of each other. That area then got submerged, the rocks began to be deformed, there was pressure and heat added, and they began to metamorphose. Then the area was uplifted in some kind of mountain formation. We may have had colliding continents again, something along those lines. And it was exposed at the sea level so that sediments were deposited on our former igneous rocks that are now metamorphic rocks. So we have a second formation here of sedimentary rocks formed on top of them. Limestones, which form from organic material like shells. Sandstones, which are sands and shales, which are muds brought in. They pile up on top. That whole area went through the same kind of process of being buried deeper and deeper, heating up, being deformed by pressures, folded, so that when you go in this area, you'll be able to see some nice folds that look almost like Christmas candy, ribbon candy. So now we've got two different metamorphic rocks sitting next to each other that come from different periods of time. That sat down below the surface of the earth for millions and millions of years. Then we had another period of mountain forming. And this is where we had, I have another t-shirt on, I won't bring it on. The one subduction leads to orogeny. Again, you have a situation where the oceanic plate is going down underneath the continental plate, beginning to melt, and lavas are coming up into it. If they reach the surface, they become volcanoes. But many times they will find cracks in areas before the surface, and they'll stay below the surface and cool, and give us rocks like granite. If any of you have been to Yosemite, that whole area is made up of granite, and it's a sort of a grayish rock that breaks in the big cliffs and stuff. That's what's happened in this area. We had different periods of it. If you get a small body of magma that doesn't reach the surface but cools in place and solidifies, it's called a pluton. And Dumbbell Mountain, right over in here, is made up of one that came about 200 million years ago. There was a later period that gave us the Holden Lake Pluton. There's a whole body that sits back up in here, and one at Copper Peak called the Copper Peak Pluton that are about 45 million years ago. So we've had a sequence of different plutons coming up. In the Copper Peak one, there were waters that were active that extracted minerals and left them lying along cracks and fissures in the rocks, concentrated them, and that's what they later mined out of Copper Mountain to give us the mine. Then within the last 5 to 10 million years, the whole area was uplifted again, moved into mountains, had a sequence of glaciation come in and carve it as we see it today. So you start, in this case, our creation story starts back about 300 or 400 million years ago, comes up to where we are today. Who knows where it'll go from here? Any questions on the Holden area? Oh, I was going to say, the last episode of geology has been the mining. We've added to the geological scene here. We've got tailings, which we'll add onto the geology. Pity the poor geologist who comes along in 5,000 years and tries to figure out what happened. All right, why don't we go on to the next slide, which is the last one. It's the one I want to have us sort of do as a group, go through geology. This is this view from the house at Tocoa, 25 Mile. And I just like to have people say what kinds of things they see, and we'll take those observations and try and weave a story out of them. It'll be somewhat similar to the one we just had at Holden because we're in the same area. But what are some of the things that strike you as you look? And don't be afraid to say things that sound too obvious. You always start with the most obvious.
Lake.
Good point. There's a lake in our group. We're going to have to explain why there's a lake in our group. That's good. If you guys have missed that one, I would have felt really mad. All right, what else?
Triglycerium.
Okay, trees. Trees will be our most recent episode in forming here. They're going to help build soils. They'll help stabilize things. They'll affect the geology. What else? Let me take the one back there and come back to Rich. What?
Those are barren.
Okay, we got rounded hills rather than the real craggy ones. So that's significant. We want to understand why that is. What were you saying?
A real V-shaped valley.
Okay, we got a really strong V here. And can you see any difference between what makes up the V and what makes up this area here? Well, I don't know. That's not a well-phrased question. But if you were able to go over there, you would realize that this area here that has a long, flat surface here, a long, flat surface here, and a sharp V, is made up of cobbles, made up of beach stones and material. Whereas the rest of these mountains are made up, again, of metamorphic rocks, much like we have up at Holden. Okay, so we're going to want to figure out a story that's going to explain how that formed. And you may mention as well, the rest of the valley here is V-shaped. That contrasts to what we have up at Holden, which is what?
U-shaped.
Okay, so what is this area not streaming?
Okay,
at least this valley does not seem to have been glacially formed.
But if you're looking at it the other way, then it is a glaciated valley.
If you're looking at what, this valley here?
Yeah.
Yes, okay, that is a good point. The valley that if you were standing on the lake, looking up Lake Chelan, you would see a beautiful U-shaped valley. So we seem to have a glacial valley coming along here and a non-glacial valley coming in through here. Something we're going to want to figure out. Anything else people want to point out?
It looks like layers kind of building up into those mountains.
In where up and through here?
Yeah.
Yeah. You've got a couple different things going on. You have metamorphic rocks that are formed in layers, and they'll express themselves like you can see along in here, along some of the areas here.
And then you thought this flat area is being a lateral moraine.
Okay, that's one good hypothesis, and we'll want to come back to that. A lateral moraine is an area that's left behind in the glaciers. A glacier moves down a valley, it picks up rocks, and then we'll move them out to the sides of the ice, and we'll leave them clinging to the sides of the valley as it moves by. And then when the glacier leaves the valley, when it recedes, you'll have benches sitting along the glacier, or the walls that are left behind. In this case, I think we've got something a little bit different that happened here. Partly you can tell by the shape, and partly you can tell by the materials. We'll come to that. Let's try and reconstruct our story now. What's that?
Let Karen tell it.
You want to tell the story?
A long time ago,
we had all those metamorphic rocks forming, and we won't go through the whole history of that. We'll come right up to the last 5 or 10 million years. The area was uplifted, we had mountains forming, okay? Then down from the polar ice cap came the ice, and it moved in under all this area. It moved into the Lake Chelan Valley, which at one point was probably a very deep river valley. If any of you have been like along the Yellowstone River, any of the great canyons in the west, which are big V-shaped valleys with rivers in them, that's probably what happened along Lake Chelan. The rivers will scour out areas of weakness. They will take the rocks that are the weakest, and they're the easiest ones to move and form a valley. Most likely there's a large fault that runs along the Lake Chelan area where the rocks have ground against each other and become weaker. The river exploits that, makes it into a big canyon. What happened then is that the ice then follows the point of the greatest weakness, which is a valley. And so the ice will fill up the valley and begin to change it from a deep V-shaped valley into a nice U-shaped valley. Form that. As the ice moves along, it will tend to scour most deeply where there are a lot of sources of ice feeding into it, which will be farther up into the mountains. There'll be a lot of ice coming down here, and it will scour deeply into that point. As it moves out onto the plain, away from the mountains, it will have less ice feeding into it, so it will have less mass and less ability to dig out its channel. So what happens then, if you were to look along the length of Lake Chelan, starting up here towards Stehekin, moving down here towards Chelan, there's a lot of ice coming in from all the different mountain valleys in here, and so the ice is heavy and is scouring and digging deeply down here. As you get farther out, you're getting less and less ice coming in, so it has less ability to dig, and so the floor of the lake will be getting relatively higher, okay? What happens then when you have a big trough or a big basin and you take the ice away? You fill it up with water. Okay, so that's basically what happened. The ice receded and you filled up the area with water. There's an artificial dam down at Chelan now, but before that there was a natural dam down there. A couple things. You have a deep trough. You also have a moraine, which is what Dorothy was talking about. As the glacier gets to an area where it cannot no longer advance, it will begin to melt and it will begin dropping all the rocks and all the things it's picked up. And these will drop down and form a dam there, and then as the glacier moves away, there'll be a wall left behind where which will dam the water. Okay, this is one of the most interesting features along here, this V here. What this is, and you can't really tell unless you go over there and look, but it's made up of beach materials. It's made up of things that rivers bring down and deposit on the edges of lakes, and then the waves will rework them and round them a lot, much as you'll see down in Lucerne here. What has happened here is the lake at one point was 300 feet higher than it is now. There was another glacier down where Chelan currently is that came along and walled off the valley down there and formed an ice dam. So the elevation of the lake was about 300 feet higher. This canyon here, the river coming down this canyon, now is depositing all its material along here. And so this was the old beach level. The old lake level was right along here, and these are all record that. At one time, this would have continued all the way across here. Then as the ice dam broke down there and the lake lowered again, this river began to carve through the beach materials that it left behind and left a classic V shape. So this is the old beach level here where the lake was much higher, and now the other stream has cut back down through it. And so you have a V-shaped valley coming into a U-shaped valley. And that gets us up to where we are today.
So there may at one time have been icebergs in Lake Chelan.
Sure.
That ice dam that would break.
Sure. Yeah, and all the way from all the ice farther up valley too.
You've got lower benches in that too in that area.
Yeah, there are several different levels. This is
That's
just
made quick you're looking at.
This is just one of the most pronounced.
How many years ago do they figure that the lake was that high on top of where I'm going to build my house when I become a millionaire right there?
The most recent ice age was about 10,000 years ago. We're within the last 10,000 years, so it's relatively recent. I mean, enough so that, you know, human beings witnessed all this. All right.
Why isn't there any, there's so little stuff growing there? Do we know anything about that?
Oh, yeah, part of it, it's just that, it's like if you're down at Lucerne and you try and walk around there, it's just all cobbles, there's very little soil, there's very little, you know, the water drains right through, it's so porous, there's nothing to hold the moisture and stuff, and so it's a lot harder for things to get a grip on it. It's kind of strange because in the rocks, you'd think that with a straight rock, they would have no ability as well, but the rocks will have nooks and crannies and cracks which soil will collect it, and so the trees will exploit that and grow on them. Part of it is also it's on a south-facing slope, which is very high.
Rattlesnakes grow.
Yeah, the rattlesnakes are pretty long. I don't know if I made any of the connections clear at all between creation, spirituality, and geology. The only thing creation, spirituality lets my excitement and enthusiasm go, and geology does as well. I really enjoy being able to see an interconnectedness with the story of the Earth and how that all works. I don't know if people are still interested, but I have about 15 minutes worth of music and slides.
One thing, Spence, in geology field, did you ever get up to Steam Mountain, which is supposed to be the biggest upheaval?
To Steam Mountain down in Oregon?
Yeah.
I've been through the area, yeah. So if folks want to leave now before we do that, or I can just cancel that, or...
Oh, no, we won't cancel it.
All right.